Hallo Brigitte.
Hallo Martin.
Hallo alle.
Hallo.
Hi.
Hello everybody.
Hi.
Hello.
Hi.
Hello, Venerable Phil.
Hello.
I have a kind of disorganized desk here, so I'm straightening things up. Okay. Can everybody hear me?
Yes.
Yes, thank you.
Yes. Good.
Yes.
I'm using my laptop, which I don't usually use. Because I'm in Phoenix.
Oh. Arizona.
In the center there?
Yes.
Oh, fine.
Jesse Michael's giving a talk the next 10 days, starting tomorrow night on Lom Rim.
Ah.
Are we all here?
I think so.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. I think so.
Yeah.
Then we can go, I think. I mean, start.
Yes, mm-hmm. Please.
Yes.
So last week, we talked about a person who has valid perception. And in particular, we talked about somebody who always had valid perception, has valid perception. And how do we know whether somebody has valid perception? We talked earlier about the fact that we ourselves have valid perception, or tsema, 99.9% of the time. And there are rare moments where we don't have valid perception. Moments where we don't have valid perception when we're not drunk or very upset or very sick, something like that. These rare moments are something like seeing a poster of a person in a place like a train station. And then when you get nearer, it turns out to be a banana, something like that. Or the squirrel that turns out to be a leaf blowing across the road. So what is it that differentiates the perception of a Buddha from our own perception? You know, is that 0.1% of valid perception? You know, how is it that a Buddha looks at things? How is it that a Buddha perceives things? Some Buddhas have names that are linked to the act of seeing. Avalokiteshvara means to look down with loving eyes. In Tibetan, Avalokiteshvara is Chenrezig. That's the name in Tibetan, Chenrezig. His holiness is thought to be an emanation of Chenrezig. Chenrezig is the deity of compassion. Chenrezig means loving eyes, or more literally, looking with loving eyes. Both the Chen and the Sik part of this Tibetan name are honorific. Chen is honorific for I, and Sik is honorific for the verb to see. So this is a special kind of seeing for a special kind of person. What a Buddha sees is or seen object. A Buddha sees objects directly without the need for a conceptual mind, which means without the need for logic. A Buddha doesn't have to figure things out, not even deeply hidden objects. A Buddha knows things directly. Now, when we say see here, for a Buddha, that means all of the senses working, all six of them, actually. The eye sense, the ear sense, the nose sense, the tongue sense, the bodily sense, and the mental sense. They're all working and seeing things directly without the need for a conceptual mind. So, what does a Buddha see? There are two parts. The first one is a word that's hard to translate in English. We sort of come up with the totality of all objects, meaning as many things as there are. And all objects means also everything in the past, in the present, and the future. Now, I don't know how you would translate that in German to get a word that means those things. It doesn't work so well in English. Maybe in German you can come up with something. But basically, it's all things, you know. And for a Buddha, all those things are manifest. They are not hidden or deeply hidden because the Buddha perceives them directly. So, when we talk about the three kinds of objects, we always have to qualify it with for whom. And the three kinds of objects now, we're going back to our normal division of objects, the manifest objects, the hidden objects, and the deeply hidden objects. So we always have to qualify that with for whom, you know. For whom are these objects manifest, or for whom are they hidden, and so on. You know, for us, emptiness is a hidden object. But for somebody who has seen emptiness directly, it's a manifest object. It has been perceived directly. For someone who has had an intellectual realization of emptiness, that intellectual realization is a manifest object, you know, a non-yur. For someone who hasn't had an intellectual realization of emptiness, the intellectual realization of emptiness is hidden to them. They only can use logic to begin to understand it. Now, for a Buddha, any object in the entire universe is the same as perceiving the color is for us. That is, the eye consciousness perceiving blue, not thinking that is blue, that is a direct perception. It's manifest to the eye consciousness. And for a Buddha, all objects fall in that category. They are directly manifest to a Buddha. Every single object in the universe. And then the second part to what is obvious to a Buddha is the what we call the ultimate nature of them, or things as they are, meaning that they are empty. What are things empty of? They are empty of having a nature of their own. So when a Buddha perceives objects, perceiving them directly, a Buddha perceives them as they really do exist. And what's the nature of their real existence? It is that they have no nature of their own. Do things have a nature? They do. Does the nature come from the object? It does not. What does it come from? Basically, our karma. And the same is true of a Buddha. A Buddha understands directly the dependent origination of all objects, meaning that everything comes from causes and conditions. So, is it not the case that objects for a person who has perceived the path of seeing, aren't they objects in their own right? Does a person on the path of seeing see objects? Well, they do, but they don't use their eye sense power. A person on the path of seeing is understanding objects with their mental sense power only. In order to have a direct perception of emptiness, you must be in a very, very deep state of meditation. Now, how does that happen? In Course 3, which I think you've all had, we talk about meditation and that there are 9 levels that we have to work to achieve. And the very deepest one is called calm abiding. Part of calm abiding called special insight. Now, calm abiding is where you simply keep the object in your awareness. You are paying attention only to that object, and your attention never varies from it. Geshe-la said that calm abiding is a bad word for this state. Your attention is the same kind of attention that you might have if you're watching a movie and you're leaning forward in your chair, just very much engrossed in the movie. The movie has you. That's all that appears to you is that movie. It's like that. It's not calm. You're just really into it. But the calm abiding means that your mind is calm, meaning that it doesn't go from thing to thing. It's only on the object. Now, special insight is where you begin to think about the object and analyze it a little bit, still in this very, very deep state of meditation. What that does is it destroys the calm abiding part, because now you're thinking about the object, meaning that your mind is moving around the object, considering it. And this kind of analysis, this kind of meditation is very, very good for understanding things. And then you go back to calm abiding. Now, when your mind then calms down, meaning that it just keeps itself on the object, the analytical part disappears. Now, there's an interesting thing that can happen. You can switch from calm abiding to special insight, back to calm abiding, to special insight, and you vary the amount of time that you spend on that. You might start doing it in 5-minute segments. 5 minutes of calm abiding, 5 minutes of special insight, back to 5 minutes of calm abiding, and so on. But then you begin to shorten that, and you get down to 5 seconds. You're 5 seconds of calm abiding, 5 seconds in special insight, then 4 seconds and 4 seconds and 2, and eventually the calm abiding and special insight become the same thing. They become integrated. And that's an even more powerful state of mind to have. And from that, you can begin to slip into what we call the form realm. Now, we abide the desire realm, and there are 6 types of being in the desire realm, which I think you've covered. You know, there's the pleasure beings, 2 types of those. We're humans, there's animals, there's craving spirits or hungry ghosts, and then there's beings that have hell realm perceptions. All of those 6 levels of beings are in the desire realm, but there's a place on top of that called the form realm, and this is where we can go. After we've brought together calm abiding and special insight and become very, very good at that. It is in the form realm, the very lowest levels of it, that we can have a direct perception of emptiness. So when we have a direct perception of emptiness, we have actually left the desire realm. We are no longer there. Now our body is sitting on the mat. That's okay. And we go back to it so we don't get lost anywhere. But our mind has traveled to a different realm. And what it is perceiving is the actual way things exist. And it's doing so with the mental part of the mind, the mental consciousness. The senses are closed down. We have left the senses in our body. We're no longer part of that body. This is a very important thing. And when we have that perception, it changes our life drastically. Now, a Buddha does understand things with their mental sense, but they also understand things with the other five senses as well, all at the same time. So a Buddha understands, a Buddha sees, a Buddha perceives all objects in the universe with all six sense powers. And that is much different from the kind of perception we have when we have our direct perception of emptiness. Up until the point, I don't know, maybe a few weeks before we achieve Buddhahood, the only way that we can perceive things directly is with this mental sense power. Perceive emptiness directly, all right? It's with this mental sense power. It will always be in meditation, meaning that our five normal sense powers are not operating. So a person on the path of seeing does see the true nature of things. But the person on the path of seeing does not see their conventional nature. Now, we talked about the two truths. Things have a conventional nature, and that is called kunsop dempa, you know, conventional truth. Conventional truth literally is truth for a deceiver. And then there's ultimate truth, which is the way things exist, really. And as normal people on the path of seeing, we see things which are ultimate truth, but we don't see things with as conventional truth at that point. When we're not on the path of seeing, or when we're not having a direct perception of emptiness, we see the conventional nature of things. A Buddha sees both truths simultaneously, conventional truth and ultimate truth. So Buddhas only have tsema. They never have non-tsema. They never have non-valid perceptions. They always and only have valid perceptions. You know, we have them 99.9% of the time. But that 0.1% of the time doesn't exist for Buddhas. You know, the 0.1% of the time where we don't have valid perceptions. Now, it's important here to realize that when we're talking about valid perceptions for us, it's valid perception with our sense powers, all right, or our mental power if we're thinking about something. Buddhas have valid perceptions of both kinds of truth, conventional and ultimate. All the time. Now, we talked about memory. You know, memories are not semas, according to the Sautrantika school. And the Sautrantikas also defined a valid perception as new or fresh. But subsequent moments of a perception are not fresh. So if you pick up a pen now and look at it, that first moment of the 64 and the duration of the finger snap, that first moment is a valid perception. But you keep seeing Penn, but the subsequent moments that you're understanding or seeing Penn are not valid perceptions in the Sao Trantica school. They're not fresh, in other words. Only the first moment of fresh. So the first moment of Buddhahood is Sema. But the moments thereafter are not Sema according to the Sao Trantica school, because they are not fresh. Now, there was a view in India around the time of Dharmakirti and later on in Tibet that a Buddha's mind is unchanging. You know, he always sees things directly. He always has omniscience. And they understood that to mean that a Buddha's mind does not change. Now, Dharmakirti said this is not true. But yes, what a Buddha perceives is emptiness, and emptiness is unchanging. But a mind is a changing thing, even for a Buddha. Now, in the reading, this position is argued that a Buddha is directly generating a fresh perception every moment. So the first moment of a Buddha's mind is a fresh perception. It's a valid perception. And then the moment after that is a fresh perception too. So each appearance of anything to a Buddha is a fresh appearance. Now, when we are remembering the blue of 5 minutes ago that we may have seen, the object blue of that memory is very weak. You know, it's fuzzy. It's not a very good copy of the object itself. And it is not the object blue that our mind was seeing, even conceptual mind was seen 5 minutes ago. But for a Buddha, every perception is a fresh one. And it is unmistaken because the object's true nature is perceived. A Buddha perceives the true nature of every object all the time. We might be having a memory of blue, which is not Sema. And a Buddha can perceive us having that memory. And that perception for a Buddha is Sema. So if we're having a memory of blue, we're not having it Sema. And a Buddha who is able to perceive everything perceives us having that memory. And that perception of a Buddha is Sema. It is a valid perception. The topic of this class has to do with the fact that everything a Buddha says is accurate, meaning that a Buddha has had and is having a Sema of every object in the universe. We have to put into our minds that this is true, that whatever a Buddha says is accurate. And to do this, there are three tests that we apply. For example, when something happens to us and the Buddha tells us, that is because you waved your arm 2,000 years ago, how do we know that that is accurate? How do we know that what the Buddha said is true? Well, we have to check it out. Lord Buddha said many times, don't believe anything I say just because I say it. You have to check it out for yourself. In other words, in order to have a valid perception of what a Buddha says, we have to check it out. Is this true? Does it hold up? So, what do we do? A classic example is a quotation from Lord Buddha, something like, if you give to others, you will have possessions. If you keep your morality, you will be happy. Now, generally, All this refers to results in the next life. But you can make them happen in this life by undertaking special practices. So, now, here's the problem. Since things that we do in this life usually give their results in the next life, how do we check that out directly? We have to rely on scriptural authority. How do we check out scriptural authority? Well, there are three tests. The first one is that a statement by Lord Buddha or a Buddha cannot be disproved by any direct perception that you have or have had. If a Buddha says something that doesn't accord with any direct perception you have had, then the scriptural authority does not check out for you. But if what a Buddha says cannot be disproved by any experience that you've had, then the first check is okay. It tests out. The second check is that the statement of the Buddha cannot be contradicted by correct reasoning. Now, the kind of reasoning we're talking about here is correct, airtight reasoning. It's not fuzzy reasoning. This is difficult. This kind of reasoning is difficult, and we have to learn how to do it. Now, in the West, if we've had college educations, we may have had some logic in college, maybe even in high school. And that's similar to Buddhist logic, but we have to become very good at this. And that's we're going to cover a little bit of reasoning in later classes in this course. And then course 13 talks a lot about it. Now, the third test is that nothing Lord Buddha ever said before contradicts what he said later. Now, this is a tricky one, because if we read sutra literally, there are contradictions in what Lord Buddha says from time to time. So here's where we get into something called, did what Lord Buddha say, was it to be taken literally or was it to be taken interpretively? For example, Lord Buddha did say to somebody, kill your mother and father. Now, obviously, this is not to be taken literally. In the context where he made the statement, he was talking about attitudes of attachment. He was saying that the father and mother of our incorrect viewpoints have to be killed. Those parents have to be killed. He wasn't talking about our actual father and mother. So how do we determine whether a statement by Lord Buddha is meant literally or figuratively? There's a large topic, a big topic in Buddhism called trange in Tibetan. Trange means figurative, literal. And Jeton Kapa wrote one of his major works on this topic. And we cover this text in course 15. There are three rules that we use to determine whether a statement is to be taken literally or figuratively. One is, now, what was the intent of the statement? What did Lord Buddha really have in mind when he made the statement? Well, the second thing that we have to consider is, does the statement contradict obvious direct perception? For example, pointing to a red wall and saying it is red. That statement contradicts a direct perception. And the third thing we consider, is there a compelling need to make the statement to achieve a certain purpose? For example, Lord Buddha did tell some of his disciples that things do have a nature of their own. And he told other disciples that things do not have a nature of their own. Now, which of these is correct? Or, you know, why did he make these statements to different groups of disciples? So we have to examine these things. You know, that's the purpose of Trange. And Jeton Kapa explains in his book how the three major Mahayana schools determine whether a statement by Lord Buddha is to be taken literally or figuratively. The topic these schools are concerned with is emptiness, though, or the nature of things. So with regard to whether we should take a statement of Lord Buddha as literal or figurative, that only applies to when he was teaching about emptiness. And sometimes it's not clear whether he's teaching about emptiness, so we need to take a look at that too. So when you read about one who has turned correct, the one who has turned correct is the victorious one, Lord Buddha, or any Buddha for that matter. This implies that Lord Buddha was at one time not correct. Then he became correct. The first 16 books of the Kangyur is the Vinaya. These books are full of stories about how previous incarnations of Lord Buddha messed up. They screwed up, you know. Turning correct is a phrase meaning becoming a Buddha, becoming omniscient, becoming one who always has correct perceptions. Now, we started talking about how do we determine that a Buddha always has correct perceptions. And the only way we can determine that is to determine whether the things that he says are always true. If a Buddha is having correct perceptions all the time, then it must be the case that what he says is always true. Why is that the case? It is the case because when a Buddha says something, he's having a perception of what he's saying, and that perception is correct. By definition, the perceptions of a Buddha are correct. So what a Buddha says then must be correct. What's left for us then is to determine whether what a Buddha is saying to us is to be taken literally or figuratively. And that's an important topic. And that is why we study Trange. And we're not going to get into Trange really in course until course 15. We'll talk about it from time to time. But we have to have a very good grounding in logic. We have to have a very good grounding in the teachings themselves, so we can begin to compare various teachings. We're going to talk about what omniscience cannot be and what omniscience is in the next class. And this will have something to do with changing and unchanging things. And to refresh your minds about changing and unchanging things, a changing thing is something that changes from moment to moment, meaning that it changes every 64th of the duration of a finger snap. And the finger snap only lasts a part of a second, maybe a third of a second. So there's something like 200 moments in a second that our mind changes. Now, not only our minds change, but things themselves change in the same way. It's interesting. I told you that the Tibetan word for world is jikten, which means basis for disintegration, basis for rot, basically. In anything cannot last more than a very, very, very short time. It doesn't have the strength to last any longer. And that's very interesting to us. Our minds are changing things. But they don't last more than, what, a 200th of a second or so. Yet they have been around forever. Now, you kind of have to get used to that. It's important to us. Because our minds change, that means that they don't have to stay the same. In fact, they cannot stay the same. And that's good for us. That means we can become omniscient. And then what are unchanging things? An unchanging thing is something that does not change from moment to moment. It comes into existence, and it is what it is until it goes out of existence. An unchanging thing is not caused. An unchanging thing does not perform a function. Classical examples of unchanging things are empty space and emptiness itself. And emptiness is a lack of a true nature of things. So these are all terms that we talk a lot about in Buddhism. And understanding of them is basic to our understanding of other things, and we just kind of have to get used to that. A Buddha's mind is a changing thing. That's true. But a Buddha's mind has fresh perceptions every moment, meaning that they are always valid. In the Sautrantika school, in the higher school, the Prasangika viewpoint, which is what we're all trying to be, fresh is not what they're concerned about. They are simply concerned about correct, which is one of the understandings of pramana, correct viewpoint, correct perception instead of fresh or valid perception. So I imagine this has made you more confused, maybe not, but now we can have some questions.
Would you mind to repeat why in the second moment of a Buddha's mind the perceptions are fresh? Because his mind is changing as well? Question mark? Thank you for brushing my head upside down.
There is no proof that all moments of a Buddha's mind are fresh. It is simply said to be that way. I don't know whether Lord Buddha taught it to be that way, or it's simply that the Sautrantika school says that it's that way.
Okay.
I think even in mind only school, mind only in middle of way schools, pramana doesn't necessarily mean. One of the definitions of pra and pramana is fresh, but another one is also correct.
Yeah.
And the Prasangika choose to use the word correct. The other schools, I think it's just Prasangikas that prefer the correct, definition. And the other ones insist on fresh, which means then that a Buddha's mind has to be a fresh perception every moment.
Okay, thank you.
Anybody else? Well, then it must have been perfectly clear. That's good to know.
No. It's Christian from Berlin. I was trying to formulate a question, mm-hmm. but it's so difficult because I was listening to what you're saying and understanding it when you're saying it, but it slipped out of my memory. Especially the three ways of proving. You were referring to things, and I cannot at this point in time remember actually what you said. But at that point in time, I know that I'm not going to understand this, what you are saying. So it's not actually a question, just a comment from my side. But I wanted to, if you briefly recap these three things you were talking about, that would help me, I think.
I could do that.
Thank you.
The first test is that what a Buddhist says is not disproved by any direct perceptions that you have had yourself. Meaning that there's nothing in your experience that is contrary to what the Buddha has said. And you've got to think about that a little bit. But if it's true that nothing in your experience contradicts what the Buddha has said, then that first test passes. The second test is that what a Buddha says cannot be contradicted by good logical reasoning. And the reasoning has to be very, very, very good, very careful, which you have to learn how to do, and you will. You can't use what we call fuzzy reasoning about this. It's got to be very precise. So if you've learned logic and learned it well, and what the Buddha has said holds up according to your reasoning, then the second test passes as well. And the third test is that nothing that the whatever statement you're considering that a Buddha has said, that he has not ever said anything else that contradicts that statement. And this is where we have to get into apparent contradictions in what Lord Buddha has said. And the contradictions will only come when the Buddha is talking about emptiness, really. So is what a Buddha said at one point to be taken literally, or is it to be taken figuratively? And then you have to compare statements after you've understood that. If the intent seems to be the same, then there's no contradiction. And then the third test passes as well. All three of these tests have to pass in order for you to say that, yes, what the Buddha said is true. And the reason we do these tests is that after a while, we are simply going to assume that everything a Buddha says is true. And if we've really done that rigorously in our own minds, then whenever you hear a Buddha say something, you might have a direct realization right there. It's possible. Now, does that help?
Yes, thank you very much. I mean, this is Christian from Berlin. Thank you for repeating. I now understood two and three. The first, I cannot remember. Just would you please recap number one for me again, and then I'm sure I can remember.
The first one is that whatever a book says does not contradict your own experience.
Okay, good.
This does not contradict what a Buddha said.
Okay. Super. Thank you. Got it.
Good, Christian. Anybody else? Well, good then. Do your readings and your homework, and I will talk to you next week.
Thank you so much, Venerable Phil. Thank you
for
teaching. Thank you, Venerable Phil.
Yeah, thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Fine. Thank you.
A nice weekend at Casa Jardin.
Particular, by the way, is gorgeous.
Lot of knives.
Cooled down. Nights are actually chilly. You can walk around, though, during the day in short sleeves, and it's like being just a little bit warm. It's nice on your skin. This is the first time I've been in Phoenix when it's been like that. I think it's possible.
Great.
So, I'll see you next week.
Okay.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.